Okay, everyone, we begin. Tonight's class is called Woman Power. And we're going to show, we'll start off with a video to get everybody in the zone. I'll do a little share screen. Nope, wrong one. There. There we go.
Study by the Pew Research Center. It found that 84% of women from around the world identify with a faith group, compared with 79.9% of men.
This devotion is despite the fact that in many religions and denominations, women do not hold positions of power.
The criteria used for the study included attendance at services of worship and frequency of prayer, and Christian women were more likely to attend religious services than men. For example, the hit movie War Room was based on the prayer life of two women.
Lord, call us to battle.
And Bishop T.D. Jakes rose to fame in part because of his Woman Thou Art Loosed ministry.
However you define me, whoever you think I was, I am not that person anymore.
Well, because it's a little bit.
Why are women generally more religious than men? Some of the reasons include biology, psychology, family environment, and social status. Women tend to be more open about sharing personal problems and are more relational than men. And for what it's worth, it seems women are well on their way to winning the battle of the arena of prayer and religion. Charlene Ingram, CBN.
Okay, everyone. So according to that Pew study, if you didn't capture the whole video, very simply, it's that women are much more religious and are participating in religious stuff. Or the way that I like to express it is, why are there more women than men at MJE? Who would like to comment upon that? You might have a thought about that. That may have crossed your mind once or twice.
Is it actually true?
Well, first of all, look at our senior fellowship class. Okay, look at our senior fellowship class. And I'll just turn around. I'll do the turnaround.
Woo!
We got Adrian. We got Chloe, and we got Evan. Socially distance, everyone. That's it. We're doing our part to stop the spread. Typically, just to give you a sense, how many years now? 14 years at MJE, invariably, Friday night dinners, the women's seats sell out Monday night. Tuesday night. Men, till Erev Shabbos, schlep it in there. Okay? And not only that, we got to do actually active recruiting, hawking the people to show up. Next, shul. Typically still more women than men. And it's always a stress. Our goal is to make it 50-50 balance. It's always a stress to get men. So I would like to hear from our august group over here. Why do you think that is?
Are there more women than men in general in New York?
Okay, so it could be just a demographic. There may be more Jewish women than men, and I think that is statistically true. It's one part, yeah. But so Adrian has a theory that women are more responsible than men.
More organized.
More organized?
Yeah, I think for Shabbat planning, yeah.
Well, so for Shabbat planning, right. So they're not going to wait till Erev Shabbos. Hey, it's Shabbos. What should I do? That's a guy thing. Not trying to indict any. There's always exceptions to that rule. So you can imagine you're the exception. What else? But just in generally, if you would go through the 5,000, you know, in the non-COVID era, who's making that weird sound? Where is it coming from?
Vinny, I would say that there's something, especially with MJE, there's the social and the taking life more seriously and the marriage potentially and religious. And I think that I think more women see the value in that, and the men don't need help. They don't need they have themselves that are good, or they're looking for more fun. So, on a generalized theme, I think it's religion doesn't give that. It gives more restriction than freedom, as far as for the type of fun and entertainment MJ is selling.
So, men who are trying to have extended adolescence, Judaism is a hindrance instead of a help. While women who are interested in creating a home and a family, MG is a help, not a hindrance. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, so there's less. So that's why there'd be less men than on an equal share of it. The men that come are more for either serious or for less exciting, crazy fun meeting people. But that's not their...
Okay, in other words, there will be men available, but they will be at bars on Amsterdam on Friday night, not at the MG dinner.
To be fair, Rabbi.
All right, Scott, be fair. Go ahead.
You know, not all men wait till like Erev Shabbos to sign up
that
for the dinners.
True.
Some sign up as they're available.
Yes.
To be fair, Scott, not all men have to plan a cross-country trip every time they come into MJE. Some of us, some of it's the Long Island Railroad. I'm just saying.
Scott, you're the exception, not the rule, in so many ways.
Scott,
I mean, Scott's got to book a five-night stay every time he comes in, so it gets trickier at that point. I'm just saying, it's a lot more involved.
That's it. Any other theories?
None that I'm going to say.
Hold on. I want to hear from. We'll take turns. We'll do a Zoom, and then we'll do a live. Yeah. Anybody in Zoom land want to make proffer a theory? All right, Adrian, you got another chance.
So biologically, women have like a clock, for reproduction, whereas men don't have that much pressure with sort of mechanisms for having children.
Okay.
Women are a little more pressed, and I think that being in the congregation, especially a religious congregation, it's going to be conducive to finding a husband and creating a family, whereas men might feel a little more comfortable. This is playing on what you said initially, that men are trying to extend their adolescent life and women are trying to create a family. Maybe there's a biological underpinning to that.
Right. I think that is true. In other words, now that, first of all, the man thinks he has all the time in the world, but it's that also is a fantasy because even though Tony Randall, the actor, had a child that when he was a 76-year-old man, that is biologically true. Avram had Yitzchak when he was 100 years old. That was not the miracle. It was the Sarah side that was the miracle. That's the point number two. But but even men, but the bottom line is that as guys get older, their interest in even having it, you know, you'll have the scenario of men who are single in their 40s and their 50s in Manhattan. And then at a certain point, they just don't, just not even interested. So there's something there. There is not only it's not a biological clock in that sense, but there is sort of a psychological clock. As men get older, they don't, how do I say this? Not meanly.
Say it meanly.
Be frank. We're adults here.
You step out of my nerves. Look, they don't age well. Men are not like wine. They do not age well. You know what I mean?
I disagree with that statement.
Okay, in this framework.
By the way, would you say also maybe male ego is more like, you know, religion will tell, direct, or guide a life, and men are like, I got it. Like, I don't want anybody.
I think that is a component. We're going to get into this by some interesting stories in the Talmud. That's what we're going to get into right now. And trying to explore, you guys, we've given various theories why women might be more interested in religion in general, and express it through they're more interested in community and family, and religion in general is a great organizing principle. Religious communities have well-organized communities. Secular communities, less so. So just from that, forget about the truth factor, just the reality of that. So that's going to be much more appealing to females. All right, Chloe.
But I also wonder, like, geographically, I do know that there's different areas where, and I wonder if it's not related to work. Like, I know here, I think there definitely are more women to men than
yes.
in New York City. In San Francisco, there are way more men to women.
Yes.
And in like Charleston, apparently there are also way more women to men. It's like a weird.
Yes, it's a weird distribution. There is a demographic point, but the Pew study that was given was about that people that beyond all religions, women are far more involved in religious life than men are. Okay. And we want to get into that. So we have, I'm just going to list off. We have a biological theory presented by Adrian. We have a sociologically, that's a biological clock. We have the sense of women are more relational, therefore they appreciate community more. There is, of course, maybe they're more mature.
Hi, Jensi.
They can't see you. The camera's on me, but all right.
Penny?
Yeah.
Can I,
yes, Jesse.
There's also potentially the idea of strength in numbers. And I say that because women, I find tradition, I could be wrong. And women, please, I mean, you guys correct me all the time. Feel free to correct me, especially on like a Friday night. I don't think women are as likely to go to an event one off by themselves, especially if they may not know people as much. Or like, I know that if there's an MJ East thing, it's women are not necessarily super pumped to walk across the park by themselves. So I think sometimes people group together, while a guy, even in New York City, is more comfortable going solo to something and popping up. And so the numbers can't, they don't necessarily skew that way because of that, but it's a possible reason. I see the face I'm getting from Steph and Anna. So I think I'm going to stop there.
Wait. Just continue on. Why the time difference in signing up, though? Why the difference?
Forget about the sign-up.
You got a plan. As soon as you started speaking, Jesse.
No, because you got a plan, guys. It's
the time
like,
difference.
I'll go.
That's not the issue, though. The time difference of signing up is like not, I mean, it's an issue because it's annoying mostly for MJE's staff.
Yeah.
But it's, it's also annoying, to be honest, lately on during COVID times on Shabbat when we don't get a minion, but we sometimes have more women than men. So I'm just, that's my personal frustration. I know there are others that feel that way. But
are we asking why the men do it, or
yeah, so like why do men not show up? But I think that like at a certain point, men get like comfortable in where they're at. And this like kind of relates to what Chaim was talking about, but like they are what they are, right? They're in their mid-30s and they're just like, okay, this is life, you know? Oh, in theory, maybe I should get married, but like, I'm not really, it could wait. And I think like that's, I think it's a different mindset of, you know, women who are in the similar age bracket who are not always putting off and putting off.
Well, I think along with that, it's the whole, it comes down to commitment. Women are more like liable early in the week to commit to something happening at the end of the week and be like, sure, that's my plans, and be very happy with it. While men, and I'll generalize now because it's not all of you, but let me see what's going on. Maybe there's a different Shabbat dinner that I want to go to instead, and I want to meet different people. So I'm not going to sign up for MJE because I usually see the same people over and over until the last minute where they're like, I guess there's nothing else going on, so I'll sign up.
Great. That makes us feel good. Anyway, so
not about MJE, about the participants. I'm saying it generally about the men. It's not everyone in this room and not the men on this Zoom or in the class.
This is true. I mean,
well, can I put forward one too?
Like, go ahead, Max. Step into the line of fire. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, unless I'm mistaken too, like women are more likely as well to like go and earn a graduate degree or receive further education, and kind of going off of kind of some of the stuff that I've heard before, I can't point to maybe a causality, but there certainly seems to be like maybe more of a willingness amongst women to sort of like re-engage or try to push or chase after something like kind of past a different point, versus I think Stephanie was putting forward the idea.
All right, guys, I want to cap our conversation because we have to go through some material. This is sort of like you open up the conversation. We got, it's a lot of healthy, motivated views, which is great. And yes. Okay, I was waiting for somebody to give that. Very good. I think, first of all, on the chat, also Chaim said that as well. There is a, not just people say that, but that's actually a position of many people, rabbis, of why are women exempt from time-bound mitzvahs? Because simply, they don't need it, because there's a greater spiritual sensitivity. Not everybody buys that, but that's at least that idea is, quote-unquote, out there. First, you know, the counter-argument is, well, there are spiritual men, there are spiritual women, and they're non-spiritual women, and they're non-spiritual men. So it's hard to know if you can make it all down to a gender. That's a little bit of hard. Okay, I'm not going to do the sheet on the share screen, because then they can't see you. Okay? So everybody has the sheet. If I send it to you, I'm going to read out Quest. I'm going to have somebody read. So who would like to read? All right, Jesse, please read the first Gemara. This is the Gemara in Sota. And loud and clear.
Rav Avira taught, in the merit of the righteous women that were in that generation, the Jewish people were redeemed from Egypt. He tells of their righteous actions. At the time when these women would go to the river to draw water, the Holy One, blessed be he, would materialize for them small fish that would enter into their pitchers. And they would therefore draw pitchers that were half filled with water and half filled with fish. And they would then come and place two pots on the fire. One pot of hot water for washing their husbands, and one pot of fish with which to feed them. And they would then take what they prepared to their husbands, to the field, and would bathe their husbands and anoint them with oil and feed them the fish and give them to drink and bond with them in sexual intercourse between the sheepfolds, i.e. between the borders and fences of the fields. As it is stated, when you lie among the sheepfolds, the wings of the dove are covered with silver and her pinions with the shimmer of gold. Which is interpreted to mean that as a reward for when you lie among the sheepfolds, the Jewish people merited to receive the plunder of Egypt. As it is stated in the continuation of the verse, as reference to the Jewish people, the wings of the dove are covered with silver and her pinions with the shimmer of gold. And when these women would become pregnant, they would come back to their homes, and when the time for them to give birth would arrive, they would go and give birth in the field under the apple tree, as it is stated, under the apple tree, I awakened you. There your mother was in travail with you. There was she in travail and brought you forth.
Okay, beautiful. Okay, so this is just to give you a context. This is talking about in the darkest hours of the slavery and the bondage of the Jews in Egypt. The situation got so bad that the men wanted nothing to do. We're going to get into what's going on, which is question number one. I'll put this in a question form. Why did the men need so much encouragement to have marital relations? In what way did the example of Amram, we're going to get to, oh, what happened to Amram? Stay tuned. I'm sorry. We're going to save that question. We're going to read the next passage of the Talmud. Max Sterling, give me a dramatic reading of the next Talmud. Then I'll go back to this question. I'm sorry. You're on mute.
Yeah, there we go.
Good.
Oh, you missed my joke. Oh, well, more to come. The verse states, and there went a man of the house of Levi and took for a wife a daughter of Levi. The Gemara asked, where did he go? Rav Yehuda bar Zevina says he went according to the advice of his daughter Miriam, as the Gemara will proceed to explain. A sage teaches, Amram, the father of Moses, was the great man of his generation. Once he said of the wicked Paro, once he saw that the wicked Pharaoh said, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. He said, we are laboring for nothing by bringing children into the world to be killed. Therefore, he arose and divorced his wife. All others who saw this followed his example and arose and divorced their wives. His daughter Miriam said to him, father, your decree is harsher for the Jewish people than that of Pharaoh's, as Pharaoh's decreed only with regards to the males, but you decreed both on the males and on the females, and now no children will be born. Additionally, Pharaoh decided to kill them only in this world, but you decreed in this world and in the world to come, as those not born will not enter the world to come. Miriam continued, additionally, concerning Pharaoh the wicked, it is uncertain whether his decree will be fulfilled, and it is uncertain if his decree will not be fulfilled. You are a righteous person, and as such, your decrees will certainly be fulfilled. As it is stated with regard to the righteous, you shall also decree a thing, and it shall be established unto you. It's impressive she's quoting Job in Egypt. But Amram accepted his daughter's words and arose and brought back, i.e. remarried his wife, and all others who saw this followed his example and arose and brought back their wives.
Okay, so phase one. So there's been two stages. Stage one was before the decree to throw the boys into the Nile. What happened? But due to the, prior to that, when the Egyptians were ramping up the level of oppressiveness with the level of the extent of the slavery, the women had to go out into the fields and do these rituals to get them to have relations and therefore have children. Why was this?
Tired.
Also, like an existential, like depression. Like, what's the point of a procreation and bringing a child into the world to watch it die?
Right. Even if it wasn't going to be necessarily at that point killed. But the still to be, you know, to be brought into a, even to be brought into a what?
Oh, into to be born a slave
nation was, as I think Daphne made a point, is that basically what did Paro successfully do in the first, according to the first Talmud story? What did he accomplish within the spirit of the men? What did Paro accomplish? What did he want to do? Because he was, remember the story of the exit, the story of chapter one of Shemot, Paro was being intimidated by the tremendous population growth. So he wants to stop them from growing. So what does he do? He pours on the work.
He broke them down. He accomplished his objective of breaking down the males. Just confidence in themselves, and so they're just like gave up. They're going to be slaves.
So I want to go into that a little bit. I want to get a little bit deeper there. In other words, what precisely internally? So you use the word confidence. Doc used the word existential. What really died or was diminished greatly within the men of the Jewish people at this point in the slavery?
Pride.
okay, let's expand. What do you mean, pride in what?
In themselves and who they are as a people. Like,
so how did that result in sexual disinterest?
If they don't feel good about themselves, why would they want to, you know, procreate with their wives and have children into this type of environment?
Okay, good.
A lack of sacrifice and purpose, almost like nihilism. You know, that there's no purpose to being alive other than pure drive and work and mystery.
But maybe it's also an identity crisis.
Hold on, one second. What are you talking about?
Oh, sorry.
Other than like the actual depression, which like is neurological, a brain chemistry thing, but other than like the biological reaction, which is actually in accordance with the more spiritual thing. There's no reason to live. There's no reason to propagate.
Right. So what Adrian and what Anna's saying, and what Dottie said before, is that what happened to the men? They had a dream. They had a dream of the Jewish people. A sense of dignity, a sense of pride, a sense of future. And what did Paro do? He made the work so difficult that he absolutely crushed it out. He just crushed it out of them. So now, the Talmud calls these women righteous. So much righteous that what? Because of their activities, the Jewish people merited to be redeemed from Egypt.
One quick comment.
Yes.
Hitler did the same thing.
Yes, he did.
Husband's word will set you free.
Right.
That was...
That's part of his mind propaganda manipulation of the people, that have controlling the millions of people. Various lies and manipulation. So question number two on the other sheet. How would non-righteous women respond to being ignored by their husbands?
With anger, with indignity.
Yeah, is this right.
It's like an anti-nag argument about to go down.
So Max, I didn't catch it, sorry.
Anti-nag argument about to go down. I'm scared.
Women don't nag.
There might be nagging, there might be scolding, there might be, general, you're going to have a Shalom Bias meltdown of epic proportions. You are not providing what I need. You're not there in this relationship. There's the two of us, but I feel like it's just the one of us. What's going on? Right? But so why did the Jewish women consciously decide not to respond in that expected way?
Because there's no time for that. You have to make sure that you survive as a people. There's no time for getting your feelings hurt.
There's a step before that. But there's a step, this is what makes them righteous. There's a step before that.
The men had an identity crisis.
Chloe from the live audience over here says they saw the big picture. Yeah. This is not only about their personal relationship with their husband. And this is why the call of the Hebrew is heard is the Nashim Hatzid Kaniyot, the righteous women. Step one, phase one, is that they see the big picture and they recognize the totality of the Jewish people right now is at an inflection point that can simply fall into the abyss. And they do, shall we say, a rather unconventional, not so sneeze. Is this, would you call this sneeze? As you understand the concept of sneeze? Modest? No. They are going out to the where the husbands are working, and they bring out hot water to bathe them, and food to feed them, and they would anoint them. So basically, what are they doing there? In one word.
Pampering.
Seducing them.
Points in the square. I was wondering, is the guy going to say that first? Or the girl going to say that first? Okay. Seduction, it's a tie. So they're literally seducing their husbands. They're also not, they're sort of like resurrecting a sense of, in other words, what is the significance of the bathing and anointing them and feeding them? What is that doing psychologically?
Restoring dignity.
It's not necessarily, you wouldn't necessarily call that necessarily a foreplay. It's not a creating a psychological state where sexual intimacy could occur. Okay, but it's part of it, but it's by washing off the dirt and the schmutz, in the sense that he's a grimy slave, she is restoring his sense of dignity and
humanity,
and giving him food and drink, and getting him, you know, in the mood and seducing him, and then going into a very small, you know, between two fences over there, and purposely trying to get what? To become pregnant. The goal is getting pregnant. Okay?
What are the two fences?
They had in their fields two, they'd have where they would have a fence, but it also double as sort of like a little corral. So they'd have a fence and then have another fence, and then would put the sheep in it, the sheepfold. Okay, they still have those in countries today, okay? Which is not the most private area in the world. But what happened to the idea of sneas? In the classic way that one does not, the laws of sneas, which is, of course, this is before, you could argue, well, this is before they're giving the Torah. That's one argument. They're not bound by any halakha, really. One possibility. Second possibility, the general... it's true that one should not have sex out in the field, right? That's a general rule. But right now, what are we at? We're at DEFCON 4. The Jewish people are going to get destroyed. It's not a time to be machmir in sneis to the extent that there won't be a Jewish people.
But is the little pen between the two fields technically having sex in the fields? I'm just saying. Maybe that's the loophole. It's like it's not technically in one field or the other. It's kind of, demilitarized zone.
They didn't just do it right in the middle of the field. They went to a semi-private area. Okay. All right. You guys can, in your own mind, you can dwell upon that. We'll move on.
I mean, is it a case of like live by them and not to die, which is to say that you have to forego sneeze and modesty at the moment in order to like sustain and,
it's pikuach nefesh, no?
Okay, all right. So it's pikuach nefesh against the entire Jewish people. Correct.
Or do as I say, not as I do.
Well, it's not a biblical prohibition if a couple who are married have sex out in a field. It's not a biblical prohibition. It's just not. It's a lack of general sniut. It's not a. Not everything's a technical factor. There was a case in the Talmud that talk about a couple, married couple, during a non-emergency situation. Were caught having sex out in the field, and they were given lashes in the court because it's not right. Okay, but I'm not gonna. That's not the focus of our class. We move on. Okay.
Is the past lashes part of the whole thing?
What?
It's a joke.
Okay, good. Next, then the situation got ramped up. Paro makes a new edict. This is the last stage of the brutality of the slavery. Kol haben hayilod hayora tashichu. Every boar that is born will be thrown into the Nile River. According to the Midrash, according to the Agada here, what was Amram, who is going to be Moshe's father, what is his argument? What does he do and what's his argument? Somebody tell me.
He separates himself from his wife. So I guess divorce, if you want to use the word divorce.
He literally divorces.
Okay, really, so literally
divorce. They get divorced.
So he didn't want to even take the chance that there would be life being born. So he divorced himself completely from his wife so that there wouldn't even be the chance that there would be conception of a child that might be a boy that's thrown into the Nile.
Yeah, what's his rationale for that?
He wants to stop the children from being murdered.
Yes.
He doesn't want to bring children into the world that are going to be murdered.
Well, yeah, well, obviously, but obviously, in other words, if there's an edict about that baby boy who will be killed, his argument is, why should I facilitate that by having a child, which 50% of them might will be a boy, and then will get be ripped away and drowned in the Nile? That's his argument.
Isn't that also a way of obeying Pharaoh's command in a lot of ways?
We're going to get to Miriam's counter argument. But before we get to Miriam's counter argument, who thinks what Amram is proposing, and since Amram is the Gadol Hador, he's the leader of the generation, all the men follow him and en masse divorce their wives. We're not going to have kids. They're going to get murdered. Who feels that's a logical, defensible, and quite frankly, reasonable position? Raise your hand. We got Max, we got Daphne, we got two. What?
Wait, who agrees?
I agree.
Daphne's on my, yeah, Daphne's agree. On my side.
Who needs that? Who this needs that misery? Dark. Who needs that? I would.
All right, Daphne and Max.
Your opinion is trash, Max.
But like, listen, you have people make the same argument.
I want to hear your generation.
You people? You have people make the same argument in our generation with like global warming and everything. No, they say, like, what kind of world am I going to bring a child into?
Right, like your situations.
No, but this is like this is more of a definitive thing. This is just is like.
But it's not though. But it,
wait, no, wait, but it is. It's enough. It's enough where I would think I would understand who needs the heartache and
but the story of having Tesla that happen proves it's not. So
it's I know the that. Fact, but the fact that we have
the fact that we have a baby that survived a baby boy that survived down the river.
I know, proves. But I say that what Amram said was very human. It was it's a very natural reaction. That's why the women are so special because they rose above it.
It is. But Miriam's point is much better because it proves that.
I know it's better.
True.
I'm just saying it's more human. I think Amram's point. Yeah, that's the whole point of why the women are so great.
It's okay, but Amram knows right. Despite your face. It's not think. It's not. It's taking it as it's definitely going to happen.
Right, Max,
this way.
Guys.
Sorry.
When we have three people talking at the same time on Zoom, nobody can hear anything. So we just have to do a very more disciplined approach here. Okay. Okay. Good. I hear that. Now I want to slowly develop the step by step. Next question. Why didn't Miriam mind her own business concerning her father divorcing her mom? If any parent, any child that you know of whose parents got divorced, the children, by and large, do not get a vote. They are told, Mommy and Daddy love you very much. We just don't love each other anymore. Okay? And variations of that kind of speech, right? Miriam feels super entitled, and not only that, who is Amram? Just a guy?
No, Amram, it's her dad.
He's a Gadol Hador. He's a Torah giant of the nation.
But
hold on,
Miriam a prophetess though at this point?
Hold on, one second. Is it a bit presumptuous of Miriam to intrude into his decision making, especially at a time of genocide?
No.
Now we'll take one out. We'll do the raise your hand and I'll answer you. Yeah, we'll do the all right, Anna.
Well, is Miriam the argument of Miriam being a prophetess then at this point? And
no,
she's
not a prophetess. She is just obviously an awesome woman, but she's a young woman. She's, I don't know, it's hard. Maybe she's like 20, something like that. Not she's not that. She's a young woman. That's all we know from the text. Go ahead. Stephanie.
Was Moshe alive yet?
No.
Okay, well, either way, I still think she was completely justified in doing what she did, because for her, he's not the leader of the people. He's her father. And so, I don't know. I think that if to save, potential Jewish people and Jewish women, she's basically saying, why are you valuing having a baby boy over a baby girl, I think that's her, I think that's totally justified.
We're going to get to her arguments. But your basic point is she is allowed because it's not a personal familiar issue. The Jewish people hang in the balance here. So therefore, she is justified, if she has a good argument, to step forward and make those arguments. I'm going to go to Jesse, I'm going to Matt, and I'm going to go to the next step.
So if it was just her family, I still think she's justified, because you're saying that she's 20 years old. She's not a six-year-old where it's, this is what mommy and daddy are doing.
They're well-formulated arguments.
But on the flip side, because like, especially if you're like older or in your 20s, you're still going to say something back to your parents. I don't know that many people that are going to take that sitting down. But it's not just her father. And it's her father is the original influencer. And he does something and everybody else follows through. So now she has to, because she is making an argument for every single other relationship and every single other potential child born, not just her potential future siblings.
Okay,
so someone's got to say it.
You like what Stephanie's saying, you're expanding it. Matt,
100%.
Different view, or you agree?
I'm on Team Steph. Boo Team Max.
So what I was going to say is, like, Miriam really loves this question because she'll also put it to Moshe when Moshe separates from Sipora, right?
That is excellent point there, Max. Good observation.
And so, like, Miriam really loves this question of, like, why you aren't with your wife. And there's a difference here and there, which makes me feel that it's just must be justified in this case and not in that other case, is because in the Chumash, Miriam gets leprosy, right? She gets Saras.
Right. This was a tremendous mitzvah. Was not good. Yes.
Yeah. So, but which is the same question. So that here her intention must be obviously different than when she'll ask it again later. So that here she is justified. It would seem, because she has the benefit of the Jewish people in mind as opposed to herself.
Excellent. Good point. Let's take it apart. What are her three arguments? What are her arguments?
Well, Dana, with Pharaoh, it's...
Now we come to the part of the evening when I start to pick on people who have been very quiet. So they may be just taking it all in. All right, so let's pick on Shayna. Shayna, what are Miriam's arguments?
She had one argument that's saying, by bringing in no children to the world, not only do you kill them in this world, but you don't even allow them to come to the world to come.
That's the second argument. What's their first argument?
Oh, that he decreed the death on males and females, whereas Paro's was only on males.
Yeah, you're worse than Paro. Paro says, we're going to kill the boys. You are basically exterminating the possibility of boys and girls. And of course, if they're not going to be in this world, they cannot be elevated and go to the next world. And then what's her third argument? She has a third argument.
Oh, that if Paro's, we don't even know if Paro's decree will be fulfilled, right, but Amram's would be.
Yes, in other words, Paro is a tyrannical despot. He has rules. He goes today. You know, he makes rules today. He will undermine them tomorrow. He's not a stable person in that sense. He changes his mind. But your decree is going to stick. You say everybody's divorcing. Everybody's divorcing. It's game over. Now, what is significance of her comparing and contrasting her dad, the exalted Amram, to Paro?
I think it gets his ego involved a bit, maybe.
Well,
you know, there's a better leader.
There's a critique in the critique. There's a double message going on. Yeah, you're more, in other words, Paro, Chloe made an excellent point here, I'll repeat it. In other words, Paro is a person who's operating with pure power politics. He needs to dominate and crush his people. One methodology, exterminate their children, their boys. Therefore, what's going to happen? The boys will die out. They'll be just girls. They will be absorbed into the Egyptian nation. And the Jews will no longer be a threat, correct? But Amram is also working in a power politics presentation. As Chloe says, where's his Amunah? There's a covenant that there'll be a Jewish people. Why are you doing this? Point number one. And you can even go further is that maybe she's also intimating, maybe not only is he had the guy's dream before, not in other words, is it purely, am I focusing on it on what should happen to the Jewish people? Or there's a egotistical fantasy that is also being crushed. And if it cannot happen, that I'm going to have the great nation, which is what men, a little patriarchy over here, that is not worth having. And she basically says, you're worth the borrow. So she does the double potch. She shows him that your arguments are intrinsically lacking. Two, it lacks an Amunah. And three, there is an implicit, your fantasy is having a great nation, which means in your world, men. Essentially, it's a sexist, patriarchal vision. While the Jewish people, the men and women, are of equal existential value. Now, here's a key move. How did Amram react to his daughter's constructive criticism of his highly personal decision? He accepted it, and according to the Talmud, he said nothing.
That's the real miracle that he accepted. Like, because kids talk back to their parents all the time. No, it really is. I had a big mouth growing up, and I'm like, why are you doing this and that? And no one listened to me. So I think that's incredible that not that she said it, but that he listened to her. That shows the greatness of Amram, that, you know, this critique coming from a girl back then, I don't know. And he listened to her. That's the real.
Remember, this is the ultimate Jewish family of all time. You have Amram and Yocheved, who had three children. Aaron, Miriam, and Moshe. Three prophets. So basically, Amram was wrong. He heard the power of her argument. And he immediately said, honey, our daughter's correct. We got to get married. And if he got married, what happened? Everybody else, because basically they viewed him in this calamitous, chaotic, difficult situation of how to navigate complex issues. They're relying upon Amram. And Amram saw that his ego was getting in the way, and he was not thinking of the situation clear. And Miriam, this is another expression of woman power, who is, in other words, our first example of woman power was the men are so diminished, they got to be, the entire Jewish people are going to be destroyed. The women save the day, and they resurrect the Jewish people sexually, have children. Second thing is, the second way is that the leadership are making a profound, albeit well-argued, mistake. Miriam steps up to the plate and makes a powerful argument, a three-pronged argument. Her father hears it and agrees. Let's now go on to our last page. So here's the key question of the night. In what sense is Miriam's heroic act, along with her fellow women, the cause of the redemption? Why are the women who were in the fields and Miriam, these two women, the Nushim Sidkanios, why are these righteous women causing the redemption? How do you explain that? Anybody have a thought?
They are the ones that displayed faith and continue to display faith. And so with that came along the redemption, I guess, of the Jewish people. I don't know.
Well, I initially objected to, like, gender racism
theory. Gender racism theory, okay.
Yeah, like, that there's something inherent in women that is different than in that. And therefore, because of that intrinsic quality, they did things that whereas men lacked that virtue.
Oh. No. So let me clarify. The key word is, it doesn't say because of the nashim, because of the women.
Yeah, redeemed. I got it.
It was because the righteous women, and the quality of righteousness, as Anna said, is they saw the big picture. And therefore, what does it mean to have emunah? I mean, what emunah says is that God has communicated to his prophets, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that there is a Jewish destiny and a Jewish future. Right now, it looks nearly impossible. There is no light in the tunnel. The men look at this as we're done, because they're looking at it in an egotistical way. There's nothing that their dream can hold on to. They feel like they're lying on the mat on a 15-round boxing match, and they're knocked out. The women see, no, there's still an angle. Where does the moon happen? Where you know that there's a possibility, and you make it happen. In other words, the women did not wait there to say, wait for it to happen. They did unconventional activities. They went to the fields to seduce their husbands to have children. Miriam, the young woman, goes to her father, who is the God Lador, and say, you're worse than Paro for divorcing mom for these three reasons. And he listens to her. That, in other words, the Yamuna fueled their unconventional approach. In one case, speaking truth to power, in this case to her dad. Her dad recognized, I was lost in an emotion. I'm going to accept that. And therefore, because of their emuna, not that because they had great emuna, Hashem, Calgon, take it away, everything is, no. Because they had the big picture, they were able to act heroically, unconventionally, out of the box, and that's what saved the Jewish people.
I think that, you know, there's a plausible explanation for why women and not men, which is that men were busy with work. And when you're cutting the weeds, and sometimes you get lost in the forest, and you lose the trees for the forest.
Okay.
When you're too deep into work, like sometimes you forget big, you get lost. What's the same? You confuse the trees for the forest.
You confuse the forest for the trees. Correct.
Got it.
Yeah. Trees for the forest. Whatever.
Yeah. So men were deeply engrossed in the gross work here,
but
what? Whereas women were a little more removed from work, and they couldn't remember what it is that's the purpose.
So here's the interesting thing. According to the tradition, the tribe of Levi were not enslaved, because they're part of a priestly caste and they're exempt. So that doesn't help out with Amram, okay? So you could argue that the men were lost in their work and they're completely crushed and the women didn't have to do the work. Okay, that's a possibility. It could be that also there's an Achilles heel of men in general of having egotistical dreams about their legacy. My son, how does a man look at his firstborn child? Is that a neutral psychological experience? No. That's my power. That's my legacy. If it's not going to happen, I'm tapped out. I'm not interested.
Rabbi Pini, but I looked at Amram as more of like, I feel like some of the women might have also like agreed with him, because, I mean, just even now in COVID, nobody even wants to go on a date. And so can you imagine living under that regime in Egypt? And, you know, who would want to have a child knowing that it's possible that that child could be killed? Or just live a life of slavery. I don't know if it's so much of like, have a boy, I don't want a child at all.
Daphne, by the way, this does not mean all the women. Again, right. It's a certain class of women. It's the Nashim Sakaniot, right. Which means that there are righteous women and there were non-righteous women. But there were a few leadership women. They're able to either influence and lead and inspire others that made all the difference. In general, in any organization and circumstance, there are a few leaders and most people are followers. That's true for men. And with the Talmud telling me, that's true for women. And how much so? We are here today because of those women. We have another 15 minutes. I want to get to our psukim here. So let me have somebody who would like to read. Raise your hand in Zoom land. You want to read?
Wait, you're not going to. I want more about leadership within the community. I like that, Ref.
Okay. We're going to get to that. We're not done. We got to keep on going. We're going to get to that. I got some stuff. Keep on going. We'll keep on going. Who wants to read out? Simone. Read us. Simone. You can read? All right. Who else? Who can read? Give me some. All right. We got Shane again. Read us out some psukim here. Shmos, chapter 2, verse 1 through 9. Take it away.
A man of the house of Levi went and married Levi's daughter. The woman became pregnant and had a son. She realized the child was special, and she kept him hidden for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him, she took a papyrus box, coating it with asphalt and pitch, and she placed the child in it. She placed it in the rushes near the bank of the Nile. The child's sister stood herself at a distance to see what would happen to him. Paro's daughter went to bathe in the Nile while her maids walked along the Nile's edge. She saw the box in the rushes and sent her slave girl to fetch it. Opening the box, she saw the boy. The infant began to cry and she had pity on it. It is one of the Hebrew boys, she said. The infant's sister said to Paro's daughter, shall I go and call a Hebrew woman to nurse the child for you? Go, replied Paro's daughter. The young girl went and got the child's own mother. Take this child and nurse it, said Paro's daughter to the mother. I will pay you a fee. The woman took the child and nursed it.
Okay, so I just want to give sort of a methodological point that this could be a class in its own right. Like, how did the Talmud know all these stories? I'll just tell you quickly. The verse prior to this is Paro's declaration, all baby boys in the Nile. Then it has a case where a man from the house of Levi, who we find out is Amram, goes marries Yocheved, and there's already and Miriam's already there. So why, there, in other words, if you already have a daughter, why are you getting remarried to the same wife? And why is it, right after coming right after the why are you doing a wedding right after the decree against the genocide against the boys? And why is this woman, this girl, who's taking lead here? Yocheved and her daughter Miriam, preserving little baby Moshe, stashing him out by the reeds in the Nile, and so they can infer that that there was a whole dynamic going on here, because the Torah rarely talks about a wedding, especially if a couple has already been married. It's weird. So the fact that the Torah is telling us that they got married and they were clearly previously married indicates that there's a backstory. So the Talmud is giving a speculation of the dynamic prior. Okay, now let's go to Brachos 10a. Let me have Melissa. Can you read from the bottom there? Brachos 10a.
Brachos 10a. Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Eliezer both said, even if a sharp sword is resting upon a person's neck, he should not prevent himself from praying for mercy, as it is stated in the words of Job, though he slay me, I will trust in him. Even though God is about to take his life, he still prays for God's mercy. How is this principle manifest in the strategy of Yocheved and Miriam to save baby Moshe?
So the Talmud says, as Melissa pointed out, that even if the blade is on your neck, it's still time to daven for Hashem's mercy. How does that apply to Yocheved and Miriam's strategy to preserve little baby Moshe? They spared no effort. But as a long-time strategy, is it really realistic that clearly what's going on? The security apparatus of the Egyptian Empire are going house to house, like the Nazis, looking for baby boys. It is not safe for little baby Moshe to be in his crib at Amram and Yocheved. What do? They're going to bring the baby to a place where you don't bring babies, which is on the edge of the Nile River, in the reeds. And not only that, you're going to stick him in there in a special little crib, and Miriam is doing lookout. How long, realistically, is that going to be effective? How long has a strategy is that? What? Well, and then he's going to cry and somebody's going to discover. So this is not a long-term strategy.
They're also banking on the fact that Pharaoh's daughter is going to have compassion on...
Well, they were hoping not to see anybody. And then when Paro's daughter shows up, what do you think Miriam thought in her mind?
That's it. It's over.
It's over, because imagine Hitler's daughter discovers a baby Jew. What is she going to do?
Wait, they were going to make like a little houseboat for Moses? That was the plan?
There was no plan. It was just save him for the next 5 minutes. There was no long-term
exactly,
plan.
Exactly. In other words, basically, that the attitude is that when you're dealing with saving a life, you got to go risky, and you got to go things that even have a remote chance if that's all you have. Mm. And if you're relying on God's mercy, even if it's basically looked like it's game over. And imagine Miriam as she saw the daughter of Paro bathing and then discovering the baby. It's over. Not only is he got discovered by an Egyptian, she got Egyptian by the Egyptian princess. So it's like if Hitler's daughter discovered a Jew during the Holocaust, what happened to that child? That baby would be killed. She might, as an expression of pride in her nation, take the baby herself and murder it in her own hands. Or at least ask the security people who are around her to do it. But that's how Hashem operated, stimulated her sense of her maternal instinct, her sense of pity for the baby boy, and she fell in love with the baby. And Miriam's there and then sees the situation, does not freak out, with a tremendous amount of poise, says, you're in the market for a wet nurse? I happen to know one. Happens to be Moshe's mom. Boom, baby is taken back back home. She gets a couple of years to raise him, and then of course brought into the castle, the palace of Paro, and the story continues. Chloe. We don't know. Oh. Okay. No, she brought him, but this is a good question. Chloe asked, how did the daughter of Paro sell little baby Moshe to her dad? So it's not the focus of our class. I'll just give you a quick answer, one answer. The bottom line is she says, Dad, I love this baby. This baby is super cute. I want to raise him. I know he's Jewish, but he'll be raised as an Egyptian, and he'll become Egyptian. It's not a problem. And, you know, Paro was obviously in a mood. All right, fine. And that's it. Princesses tend to get what they want.
Jewish and Egyptian. Wait, so hold on. This whole, all these stories are so meshugadika that I can't even make sense of it. And I was also just working on the Akeda with my Chavrusa today. And it's just it seems this pressing thing to me in the Torah and everything that like Amunah is kind of the only way to rectify it, right? Is that an insane thing to say in turn? But there's just these things happen that shouldn't happen.
Okay, true. There is divine providence. Yes. There is a phenomenon divine, and this is an example of divine providence. I want to do three quick case studies because I'm down to 6 minutes. So let me go quickly. Fine. Case, we're not, what I always like to do is bring the class to do how does it help these ideas help us as individuals. Case study number one, Johnny MJEer has got into a fight with his long-term girlfriend, Sarah. He is very angry. He wants to dump her. How would the arguments of Miriam concerning her father Amram's decision to divorce her mother apply here?
Dump her.
Well, not because now
they should work it out.
In other words, being that the relationship when a Jewish man and a Jewish woman get together, yes, the relationship is important, but it's much, much more than just the relationship. They're talking about the future of the Jewish people. So if if you got into a fight, you got to do your best to try to break a reconciliation, because there's more at stake than just finding a romantic partner. This person is critical in bringing on the Jewish people. So therefore, now obviously, if the two people hate each other's guts, obviously that's not a good relationship. But my point being is that a person has to go a little bit extra, has to try to work things out a little more. And it might work out, it might not. But the bottom line is to go beyond the personal fantasy, the personal romantic sense of things, little big picture, inject a little bit of big picture into the perspective, and therefore try to work it out a little more instead of saying, you know, I'm done. Yes. Adrian with a response. Yes.
Not a response, an add-on.
Add-on. Yeah, go.
Well, the video that you shared on WhatsApp from Rabbi Sachs, shared lesson that he gave on YouTube, Rabbi Sachs mentioned that he was celebrating his anniversary with his wife, and they were like alone because of COVID-19.
Right.
And he said, well, and he wasn't with his children, grandchildren. And he said, like, he looked at her and he's like, well, that's how we started. And that they had like a lovely day, and they drank some
champagne. Right.
So it just brings that to mind.
Yes. There is the key thing, a Jewish man, a Jewish woman have to try a little harder, because what's at stake is much more than it's not 1 + 1 = 2, it's 1 + 1 = the Jewish people. And when you have that at stake, you cannot be superficial.
How did that math work?
And being, you have to, what they call, really work for the relationship. If it doesn't work out, the Torah has a thing called divorce. Okay, there is a divorce mechanism. You don't have to be, there's no hostages. But my point is that a person should endeavor, first of all, to date, to have build a Jewish home, no wait around, and B, try to make it work as best you can. And it is hard. It's hard. But you got to work harder. I got to keep on going.
Hold on.
Let me get
no jokes. I've got jokes. They're just dying on the vine.
Okay, all right. Max, we're going to share the joke. Hold on. Case study.
No, I can't anymore. It's already too.
Jessica MJ Ear has reached out to her friend Nancy multiple times. Nancy seems to be ghosting her. She declares in her frustration, I am unfriending her. How? In every way, in every platform. How would the orientation of the righteous women of Israel respond to the situation?
It's a good for you.
Let her go.
Have emunah. We don't know what happened to this girl, why she's ignoring
exactly.
you.
Exactly. In other words, don't be quick
judge
to judge.
Favorably.
She does not respond to me. You don't know what's happening in her life. You got to get her side of the story. Maybe her mother is ill and she's been completely overwhelmed by that. Maybe she's in a typical job situation that she's just depressed and she doesn't have any juice left. First, be empathetic and try what's going on and not be quick to judge. Do not be quick to judge and dismiss. Last case. Case study number 3. Melanie MJ Ear is running for her dream job. She's already had 2 rounds of interviews. The competition for this role is fierce. The stress is killing her. The company called her and asked her to produce a written plan to deal with a particular problem as a way for the hiring team to determine who they should hire among the last 3 candidates. She is emotionally spent from this 2-month process. She does not feel she has the energy to be creative and craft an amazing presentation. What does the philosophy of Miriam and Yocheved instruct her to do? You got to move forward. That's it. There is one time to rest in life. You know when that is? When you're dead. Game on.
Put a baby in a basket.
If you have an opportunity, You have an opportunity, even if the opportunity is remote, you gotta put everything into it. Miriam and Yocheved thought they're going to see their baby, their little baby Moshe, her little brother, be exterminated in front of her eyes. They did everything they could to navigate that to the last second when the blade was on the neck. That's the Jewish approach to Jewish history is exactly this. It's always when things are always on the way, way down. There is no light. We keep on moving forward. We have Amuna that there is a big, glorious future. And with that, that fuels energy to make it happen. We don't wait till it to happen. We make it happen. And with God's blessings, it does happen. And that's Miriam, and that's Yocheved. And for what? And going back, Jewish women have, whether it be a maternal thing of a sensitivity, a greater appreciation of the Jewish people, because they are the ones that bring that Jewish people into being. They recognize the value of the Jewish home a little more than a guy does for the reasons we mentioned. And that maybe given them the edge to express their righteousness, at least some of them, which in collective save the Jewish people from absolute destruction.
Oh man.
Except in like, it doesn't really work that way though.
Well, go ahead, Stephanie.
Like, I'm just going to be real. We started this conversation about, what else is new? About women in leadership. And I think that there's still a huge hurdle in the Jewish community for women to take on and show a leadership.
So one thing we see over here.
We got to mute Deb. Deb for Rabbi Mark Wilds is... butting in. Thank you.
Okay, I just muted him. Okay. So we can learn from Miriam a couple of things about women's attitude toward leadership. She didn't say, Amram, you're wrong. I should be the Gadol Hador. I should be the leader. Step out of the way. She understands that there's a role for it, but she was not shy about pointing out that he was making a gross error. She did not feel the need to be complete, that she has to be identical to a man in every way. There's a place to be her own person in her own way, and therefore she's not impacted by the situation. And in this situation, their leadership manifests in their own way, in their own style, was critical. The Talmud says if it wasn't for them, there would be no Jewish people. So it doesn't mean that therefore she said, because of that, I should be Amram. I should be the rabbi of the Jewish community. She didn't say that because she didn't feel that need that has to be that way. So can you infer? So that's a key point. Leadership, we have to distinguish between leadership and titles. They're not the same thing. And there's a difference between leadership and influence. They're not the same thing again. She did not have the title, but she did have the influence. And she did use it effectively, and she used it powerfully. And that is an opportunity that's available for both. It's not just women supposed to learn from Miriam. Men are supposed to learn from Miriam, too. She is here to educate men and women. Yes. We're on the Rabbi Sachs one. All right, go ahead. We'll end up with Rabbi Sachs. Yes.
That was delivered so beautifully by Rabbi Sachs' daughter.
Hila, yes.
She said that, like, when they would be at home and sometimes eating, like, in the kitchen or something, like, I think
when the kettle was boiling.
And they would be speaking about how to resolve racism and how to resolve
world anti-Semitism.
Correct. And she said that her father's attitude, Rabbi Sachs' attitude, was that every problem can be solved, even things as big as, anti-Semitism, global anti-Semitism. And it seems like he embodied this attitude.
Yes, he did. Mentioned. Yes, and I would add, and what Adrian I encourage everybody, we had a very, those who were joined my Parsha class on Tuesday night, we had Gila Sachs, Rabbi Sachs's daughter's eulogy, which we used as a example of eulogy, and we went from there. And one of the stories she shared and about what she learned from her father was when the, and they're British, so when the kettle was boiling for some tea in the kitchen, the conversation that he would have with her and with anybody who was around was, how are we going to solve global anti-Semitism? In other words, he viewed all problems as being solvable. And also he viewed her, not because she has a voice and she has a good insight. It should be celebrated. So she did not feel diminished or dismissed. She felt lifted up by her father in so many ways. And one of the ways is he did not make us feel that we had to become him. He allowed us to become us, which was also very powerful. And that's also, each person you don't have to be a leader. You have to be a leader of yourself, but you do have to use that influence to improve yourself, your family, your friends, and the world to the extent that you can. And that we should learn from Miriam. In a certain sense, it's woman power, but it's really the best. Really, you can make it more universal how power should be used in general. It's not a gender issue, ultimately. It was Amram that was stuck in a gender perspective. But ultimately, it's how do I use my influence to bring justice to the world? Kindness to the world. And what can I do for the Jewish people? What can I do for the Jewish people? How can I make the Jewish people better? How can I lift everybody up? That's the question. So,
this country was born on that principle. Common Change, Common Sense article. It was about common sense. And it was, created
those. Yes, yes. All right, I'm on the way over time. It's against my religion to schlep over time. So, I want to thank you all. It was great having you guys. And again, special Yasher Koach to Adrian and Chloe and Evan for coming live. Makes it a nice dynamic. And we all observed the COVID rules very nicely. And look forward to seeing you guys next week, everyone. Lila Toh.
Thank you so much, Ray Penny. Good night, Lila.
Thank you.